All right. What up? Welcome in. Tuesday, October 4th. We are officially in spooky season. If the stock market didn't spook you enough in September. I don't know if that if resonates with anybody else, but me, I was sad. I will say, Javier, lots to talk about today, you know, man.
Alan Brockstein would disagree with
you. I was just about to say Alan Brockstein. Stop reading my mind. This is spooky season. You're not supposed to be solidifying your psychosis here. Anyways, continue on.
So, welcome everyone to another episode of the NVIDIA Cannabis Insider.
I guess don't continue on, Javi. Make me look stupid.
Analysis. We don't give a crap about chit-chat today. We're going to go right into what matters.
Always.
This December, the global cannabis stock index, which is something that Alan Brockstein and New Cannabis Ventures and 420 Investor put out every month, ended the month down 25.9%. Even the four strongest names in September all fell, including Innovative Industrial Properties or IIPR. Another real estate company called Chicago Atlantic, which is REFI on the stock exchange, then Cronos, CRON, and Turning Point Brands, TPB, all of them were down in September. Nonetheless, Brockstein's report noted that despite including the worst month in 3 years, the quarterly return, which was also bad historically, was not nearly the worst. Mm-hmm. He argues that all of this decline continues to seem unjustified, that there were no negative industry news or no material changes in company operations.
It's exhaustion. I mean, don't you think, Javi? Like, it's just material exhaustion with the state of federal or lack of federal regulation when it comes to cannabis. It's the state of these stocks hitting a ceiling.
That was not driven by fundamentals for so many years, several years, and now suddenly the fundamentals are there and they're still not driving stock prices, right? It's anything but fundamentals. It's external events.
Here's what's been driving stock prices, and you can tell anytime there's some sort of legislative hope, a legislative glimmer of something being passed on Capitol Hill, you see those Canadian stocks skyrocket. The Tilrays, the Sundials, the Village Farms, the Auroras, the Canopies, you see them just to the moon. And it's because they are accessible. And that is the only reason. No offense to those stocks. There's plenty of reason why they should go up and down. And you know me, I'm a huge fan of companies like Village Farms and Sundial. Or I'm sorry, SNDL now. Sandal. I want to call it Sandal so bad. But with that being said, there's obviously no reason, unless they are actually in the States, for them to move on that news. But with that being said, the U.S. stocks are continually left out of movement. We watch the Canadian stocks for those. Anyway, there's a lot we can go in there, a lot we can commiserate with when it comes to our audience. But that being said, we have an exciting interview for you today with Managing Director of Shark Capital, Colin Campbell. We'll get him over in a second. We have a few more news lines we want to touch on first. So, Javi, you know, I listened to a podcast, a sports podcast. I won't go too deep into details, but this guy's name is Dan. His name's Dan, and he has a Dan in the Dumps story in every podcast. And I need to bring in, like, Elliot the Eeyore story or some Elliot the depressing elephant story or something when it comes to these stocks. Because last week, Canopy Growth threw us for a loop with just getting out of Canada. This week, somebody tell me what the hell is happening with MedMen. Like, what are they doing? You should not have leased to us under federal rules, so we're just not going to pay you. I mean, is there any other part to that story? I haven't found one. I haven't found one to support MedMen.
Yeah. I mean, the trouble for MedMen are never ending, honestly.
They just don't want to pay their rent. Oh, me too. Like, I don't want to pay it either, but I still do.
Here's the thing. MedMen, of course, is saying that it's Thor Equities that was in the wrong for renting to a federally illegal cannabis company.
I know, exactly. And if MedMen wins this case,
great argument to make as a cannabis company or anyone participating in the industry, like, hey, you know, don't be renting to illegal businesses if you don't want the trouble, because then where the hell will you set up shop?
But Deborah Borchardt said it best in her story this morning, you know, and I really appreciated her perspective here, was if they win or somehow get out of this, they don't have to win. It just has to be settled in their favor. That is going to be a big discouragement to other landlords to lease to cannabis companies until there's federal legality. And that is such a crap move from a company that has gone through the ups and downs of this industry.
It is problematic. On the other hand, always like trying to look at the flip side of this.
Of course.
A bunch of real estate companies suddenly got locked out of the opportunity and were forced to lobby harder for legalization because they realized that it's a very big missed opportunity.
But nobody's locking them out. They're just not.
What would happen, right, if this discourse continued to move forward? Like, hey, you know, renting property to cannabis companies is not worth the risk.
It depends on the state of each market. You know, it depends on in New York City, if there's a ton of open storefronts and you want cannabis companies to come and rent your space, then maybe they hop on that train. But in markets where like Chicago, where, you know, it's maybe a little bit less of an issue, maybe in LA, it's more of an issue. I don't know. I think it depends on the market to the extent of whether or not real estate companies start to back cannabis or they just stop leasing to the industry as a whole. That to me, I don't know. And Thor Equities is no stranger to cannabis.
No.
You know, from what I understand, they leased to cannabis companies before MedMen.
Oh, yeah.
So
they very well know what they're doing, right? It seems more of a legal argument to MedMen than.
Anyways, I didn't mean to derail us. I'm just like, for real, like, can we sit at the grown-ups table? Like, just for once. Anyways, Javier, give us a lightning round, man. Give us a few storylines covering your mind right now.
Let's do it. I mean, one is some bad news out of the UK where police commissioners are calling for harsh penalties for cannabis at the Conservative Party conference. Basically, they're saying, you know, we need to reclassify cannabis, but in the opposite direction as everyone else who is lobbying for the rescheduling of cannabis in the US. And they say, like, you know, actually, cannabis is more harmful than what we thought in the past, which...
Yo, the rhetoric is moving.
And what they're proposing is, like, you know, to equate cannabis to speed and ketamine for recreational purposes, because we do know ketamine is being
special
used
in
drug addiction and treatment-resistant depression. Mm-hmm. And people could face up to 14 years. It's ridiculous. And now they want to move it to an either stricter or more stringent category, Class A in the UK, where they include heroin, cocaine, and ecstasy, and people could face lifetime or life in prison.
So, Javi, let me give you a little looping perspective here. So yesterday, Pablo Zuanich from the Cantor Fitzgerald released a note saying he is now bullish, optimistic, hopeful, glass half full, whatever you want to say. He thinks SAFE Plus will be passed in the lame duck session. Plus being help for veterans, help for small businesses, and I think assistance to states for expungement. Those three things on the plus. SAFE, of course, is banking access for cannabis businesses federally, which is fantastic, and it takes pressure off that small to medium-sized business in this industry. So we have also seen an intense increase over the last week, maybe 2 weeks, of anti-marijuana rhetoric from psychology journals, from lobbying groups, from political parties, from Fox News. So it does get the juices flowing. Is Pablo right? Are we actually moving towards something with marijuana, giving this 117th Congress a last win? And there's actually maybe an increased rhetoric to try and stall that, to play it back, to bring it back. You know, I'm not saying everything's a conspiracy. I'm not really like that, but it's just a thought, you know?
But like concerted efforts are not conspiracies, right? Like I am 100% anti-conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
But there is such a thing as a concerted effort. We have it on our end as well, right? And people for legalization like myself talk to other people and organizations and organize our efforts to advocate for cannabis legalization. We're seeing certainly the same on the opposite end of the spectrum. It makes sense. It is fair. It is democratic. It doesn't mean that these people don't suck.
El Guapotron 4000, I think your wires are a little crossed, sir. You have two extra letters.
You know him.
You have two extra letters, sir, in that hashtag. I refuse to read it. Also, thank you for tuning in. Appreciate you.
Always. So three quick
buttons,
and let's jump to the interview. First one is to our good friends at Truly, that is TCNNF, TCNNF on the OTC. They're launching Khalifa Kush, that is Wiz Khalifa's cannabis brand in Florida, and a few select locations. Find out which ones on benzinga.com/cannabis. And they will donate some of the proceeds to people affected by Hurricane Ian. And then some recommendations that I would like to make for after the show at benzinga.com/cannabis. One of them is an analysis by Viridian Capital Advisors on how the market is valuing cannabis versus tobacco, alcohol, and pharmaceutical stocks. And another one looking coincidentally at ketamine to treat alcohol addiction. Very, very cool series by Lara Goldstein. I really suggest you go check it out. Other than that, I got Snoop Dogg teaming up with an edibles producer called Sumo Snacks to launch some THC-infused snacks, and Ricky Williams partnering with Chris Ball, two former NFL stars, to launch a collaborative cannabis strain inspired by Boys in the Hood. That was a Benzinga exclusive. You can check the details on benzinga.com/cannabis. Make sure to check it every day. We have more exclusives than any other outlet out there. So if you want to hear about what's going on in the industry before anyone else, benzinga.com/cannabis is the place to be.
Thank you, El Guapotron, for the clarification there. Javi, as always, thank you. Everybody subscribe to benzinga.com's cannabis daily newsletter every weekday morning. Just search it. If you share it with your friends, you also get swag from us. I mean, it's a win-win. That being said, if you guys want to get a little bit smarter, stick around for this interview with Colin Campbell, Managing Director of Shark Capital, an awesome, awesome investment bank in this space. We're going to pick his brain right now.
Where is he calling in?
Boo!
You did not like my joke.
Colin, did you hear this before, Colin?
Was that where am I calling in from?
It was. Yeah. He had a great fish joke yesterday, too. Javier is on point with the puns, but we're not going to let him have too much stage time on that. We're going to turn it right over to you. You've been on before. This is your second time joining us, Colin. So No need to go super in depth into, you know, Shark Capital and what you all do in the space. Instead, I'd like to talk about more what's happening in the space. So, Colin, just a quick recap of what you do at Shark, and then maybe let's start with a little bit of a near-term industry outlook.
Yeah. So our three main areas of focus is mergers and acquisitions, capital raise, and we have a dedicated distress team, which is getting ramped up on the space, and I think they're going to be relevant. I've been saying that since kind of Q1, and I'll tell you, it hasn't been as bloody in the streets as I sort of thought it was going to be, but we are seeing things coming down the pipe that say be a rough one. I had hoped to come on today and talk about some of the deals that we just got done. They haven't quite closed yet, so please stay tuned. But I think there's a couple interesting case studies that are going to come out probably this month, maybe a little bit early next month, on some of the deals we're working on. There is distress. Say it's been tough. Capital is tight. Capital is very constrained, and it's concentrated in a very limited number of parties. We're having a lot of occasional conversations with operators, both plant touching and in terms of where their valuations actually are. There seems to be, I think operators are coming to a little bit of a realization that maybe valuations are thought it is, and public companies may not necessarily be the best comps if they're a private entity dealing with capital issues. This is an incredibly complicated and competitive space to be in. further exacerbated by the legal, the regulatory, and the illicit market dynamics that are just impacting everybody. So it's a fascinating industry. I've made the comment last time, I'll say it again. As a retail investor, I gotta believe in having discipline and having a methodology. I'm a big fan of dollar cost averaging in and dollar cost averaging out and having rules. And it's not a bad thing to reevaluate your investment thesis. All of that being said, I think there's a lot of great opportunities in the space right now. And where that impacts the M&A environment is fascinating, because traditional wisdom would tell you the equity is so discounted right now in some of these public entities, they're not going to want to use it as currency in a deal. But yet there's so little cash and liquidity, you can't really buy companies with cash either. So the M&A deals we see getting done, they're largely structured. There's a lot of seller financing. There's a lot of paper changing hands, very little cash. There's a lot of earnouts, valuation are potentially discounted, even in the ancillaries for packaging companies. We've got an incredible fintech client right now, and we're talking to some of the traditional fintech venture capital and strategic companies, and they're developing a real thesis in the cannabis space. I think in many cases, some of your big institutionals have been reaching out to us past two or three quarters as they develop the thesis, how to invest in cannabis without necessarily touching the plant. And I think it's technology. I think it's ancillaries. And I'm getting there. Many of them are probably still 6 to 12 months away from being able to write an equity check. But some of them have told me they can't write an equity check for less than $50 million. And I'm like, that's going to move the entire market in cannabis. So don't do that. Yeah. Well, not yet. But I mean, it's coming. It's coming. I think we still have some tough waters ahead through the end of the year and into next year. But if something like Safe Plus were, which I'm not going to sit here and try and handicap that. I think recent history is littered with the bodies of companies that have tried to gamble and build the business around the federal government being able to execute on any sort of timeline. But I think something like that could be a catalyst, guys, from an investor standpoint. Be disciplined, be thoughtful, think about how this fits in your overall allocation, dollar cost average into it if you can. And I think there's a lot of opportunities right now.
I have two questions for you, right? One is you mentioned these three factors that to me would basically spell a halt in M&A, right? You say depressed valuations for the buyer who can't use its equity as currency, or it's not particularly favorable. For a company being acquired, they won't get the best valuation they could get. And there's no cash. To me, that would spell like, you know, M&A halt. Why is M&A still going on? Is it going on as strong as you expected? Is it going on as strong as prior years? Like, what's going on there?
It's not as strong as prior years, right? When everything is frothy, deals get done, it's silly valuations, and nobody thinks about it. I think we're dealing with a little bit of a hangover. And I think first volumes have come down. Now, if you think about just the spread of the overall M&A market, the top sector of the market in a situation like can go to zero. Your multi-billion dollar deals happen. But the middle market, the lower middle market, those deals never go to zero. There's always some trades happening. And it's because they sort of have to, right? And so in this case, even though there's not a lot of cash changes, because of the industry we operate in is so incredibly competitive for all of the reasons we all already know, that companies, in order to survive, have to do effectively paper mergers in order to achieve that scale that they couldn't otherwise achieve when they went and they raised $100 in the private or public markets, only to realize, you mean Cal doesn't need more cultivation? Like, obviously, probably not the best example of a great place to deploy new capital, right? So in those cases, there has to be some sort of realization, normalization, right? Some of them go away, but as there are brands, there are businesses that have a real reason to exist, that have a good product or have unique assets or have a unique something. And those are the deals that are getting done. The other way we see deals getting done, and particularly when there's something fundamental about that's worth investing in, is when there's a unique asset or a unique vehicle. So we're seeing preferreds getting done with, you know, half times pref and personal guarantees from Blurred. Like, those deals can get done and they're good companies, but just a traditional common stock, you know, investment, that's going to be a tough putt right now in this capital markets environment.
So I'd love to capitalize on one thing you said before as well, and mixed in with what you're talking about now. We're really focusing in on the plant touching companies when it comes to the saturation of the overall market, the valuations, you know, that are just not correct. But when looking at other opportunities, especially to start the year, we saw software and tech have probably the most amount of equity investments. We see a ton of hydroponics companies also flailing, but that space isn't crazy saturated. I mean, there are some leaders that, like an AgriFi that does, you know, kind of a full-scale strain partner to an Urban Grow that also does construction and design. You know, there's different levels of it, but those are still getting destroyed as well. How does an investor look at those and analyze those adjacent to the cannabis space? Because it doesn't seem to me that it's the same problem as much as they're just associated with the wrong industry.
Well, that's exactly it. And I think where we drill down into it is how much of your business is actually coming from cannabis. And I use, you know, hydroponics as an example. There's a lot of companies that are targeting the at-home cultivator or other industries, other crop types. I think to the extent that they're getting penetration in cannabis in particular, it means good margins. It means good growth. It means a good business and a good runway in the future. But to traditional capital, it has the scent of cannabis on it, and therefore they automatically get this cannabis discount, which is completely unreasonable and unfair and will ultimately go away. But that's the reality of what we're dealing with today. I can't tell you how many times, and to El Guapo's point, I get pitch decks on new cultivation probably every week as well. The problem is that I don't always look. I'm the guy that's going to tell you what I believe to be true. You may not like it. You may not want to hear what I have to say, but I'm always going to tell you exactly what I believe is reality. And we all operate within the confines of reality.
Oh, that's a good advisor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Living up to that last name, that last word in your company name there.
Yeah.
So I'd love to add a follow-up question onto this. What the overall health of public companies does not seem to be positive in this conversation. Can you chat a little bit about what is a healthy company right now? Is there one in cannabis? Is there an example that you can give to us as that company doesn't suck?
Yeah. I mean, so I put out an article in Q1 that looked at public companies, and I think it was like of the 375 companies I looked at in North America, probably 17 of them had reason to be public. The rest didn't.
Yeah. Very true. Very, very true.
I'm sorry. And we can debate those 17. I think, look, what's interesting now is you look at a company like GTI, right? In fact, I'll pull them up real quick. So GTI is interesting. They actually have EBITDA.
Mm-hmm.
Now you look at the CapEx, $215 million of CapEx with 321 of EBITDA. What happens when they've sort of reached max build out and a lot of that CapEx starts to go away? That company cash flows like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great business, right? They've achieved scale. They've achieved real margins. They have actual operations. They're generating real cash flow. They're able to reinvest back into their business. That to me is the sign of a good public company. There are other public companies that haven't achieved the same scale or pursuing a different model. And you look at them largely being dependent upon pipes to come in and support the company. I don't know how sustainable that is over the long term, but their model, and Elliot, you kind of asked me about this last time and I tried to duck it. You know, that model, time will tell how sustainable that model is. I think it's a risky bet on reaching scale and particular catalysts like SAFE, like other things, interstate, descheduling. You know, it's a game and it could pay off great. You know what? Mm-hmm. And those investors will look brilliant and that company will win. I just don't know enough. traditional wisdom would say companies that generate cash flow, that's a good company.
You know, you're talking about PIPE investments, right? That is private investment in public equity. I've been thinking about that quite a bit in recent times. I've seen quite a few PIPE deals. And you were also talking about the cannabis discount, right? We do know that some of the cannabis-focused VCs did very well in the early years. They haven't been doing so well recently. Many of them, some of them have. So where's the money coming from, right? There are these like silent, discrete pockets of capital, right? Where is the capital flowing into the industry coming from, and why? Why are these more mainstream institutional investors recognizing the capital? Why are you considering you're in constant conversation with people?
So my background prior to cannabis was technology. And so a lot of the traditional business and technology services, institutional investors I talked to all said the same thing. We get it. My departure into cannabis, they're like, we get it. We're not there yet. And at the time, this was a couple of years ago, they were actively building special vehicles with a curated list of LPs that excluded some of the pension funds and everything else that would understand the business model, let's say technology. They get the concept of MRR and ARR, right? They get the concept of high margin, high growth, highly scalable businesses. It just happened to be serving an industry that was growing at double digit CAGRs. Well, those investors are coming, right? Some of them are quietly starting to actually show up. Many of them are still probably 6 to 12 months away. And I keep saying that for the last 6 to 12 months, but eventually I'm going to be right and they will come in. Right now, the deals I see getting done, it's the private wealth, it's the high net worth individuals in the family offices, right? And they're able to deploy checks in the 2, 3, 5, maybe even a $10 million range if they club it together a little bit. But they're going in quietly. It's private money. They don't want to make a big splash.
It's funny. They're very risk averse when it comes to reputation and 0% risk averse when it comes to their investments.
Right. Right.
It's almost moronic.
But that should be, you know, that's where I say, I think there are bright lights on the horizon, right? And those of them where I think you've got smart people, sophisticated investors that are able to, they're willing to take the risk personally or with their family funds to start planting seeds. And I think they recognize the fact that the industry is probably unfairly beaten up. Valuations are probably too deeply discounted. That even on a risk-adjusted basis, this still makes a good entry point. And that's where I think you start to see them coming in quietly. Now, we've been approached by a couple. We know that they actually have some rather large pools of capital, and they're looking for the right interesting opportunity. They're coming at it very much from a lens of they want a real business. They want real operators. And that's where I go back to a company that has some scale, a company that has unique assets, whether it be brands, locations, operations, products, or management team, right? Mm-hmm. Something unique about it now all of a sudden differentiates from an industry that is just awash with good companies, but not necessarily differentiated, right? And I think that's where they're able to be very picky because they have capital when so few actually do.
All right. So I'm going to finish up on this here, and then we'll let El Guapo throw in 4,000. Let his question be the last. But for me, I'm going to narrow this down a little bit from prior conversations you and I have had about brands and the opportunity of brands here being asset light versus asset heavy. Why are investors okay with it now? Are they okay with it now? Are they okay with it because they're so exhausted with actual vertically integrated operators and the performance there? The reason being is generally you had to have assets, it seemed, to get financing for a couple of years there. Now that's not necessarily the case. And I want to add on another question to that, if I may. Brands, are they really a thing yet? Because to me, it seems like you have to have marketing to have a household name, and cannabis doesn't have that yet. You have to have brand recognition across multiple states, multiple points of entry, and there are very few brands that have it yet. Some would say cookies, but I think cookies is retail. I think that's a retail chain. I think that's brick and mortar that has penetrated multiple markets via partnerships, similar to MSOs like Zenleaf and Beyond Hello, as we were saying before. So my point to you is, when will the brands as we know them, these IP, you know, kind of strain brands, actually begin to penetrate and become an investable opportunity for investors?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think life being an executive in branding and marketing, we have this debate around the dinner table all the time. Brands don't currently exist in cannabis, but for the rare few. And I think I would say Can is an example, Wild, Kiva, right? There's a couple others that are just incredible examples. They've actually built a brand. But generally, I can count on one hand, maybe two, the brands that exist across this industry. And there's some that are, you know, legacy brands that are, I would describe as iconic. One of our clients, I think it's an iconic brand, and it has a reason to exist because it has differentiated technology, products. There's something special about it. But if it's just flower, I don't know, that's tough to brand. I think the other issue we run into is that the consumer is still, and this is not a bad thing, but the consumer is still relatively immature. And I think there's a lot of promiscuity from the consumer standpoint. They want to try different brands. They want to try different form factors. They want to try different retail experiences. And so they're very promiscuous in that respect. The other issue is, I think, and I get approached by a lot of companies that have just PhDs and data scientists and all these chemists that are building these incredible products. And the problem is that the sales chain, the sales channel, and nothing against bud tenders, but in many cases, they're not sophisticated enough to really properly explain what the value proposition of that brand or that science is that underpins that brand that makes it unique and special. At the same time, nor is the consumer really capable or prepared to absorb all that and understand it. They want something that makes them sleep, something that makes them feel better. And it's like, here's the assortment, right? So it's tough to build a brand right now. I think some of the companies have been able to do it well, but at scale, I think you're right. It's the retailers, right? It's the big mega MSO brands and all of the stuff underneath it. It's hard to develop that value. I just don't know that we're there yet.
What a great point. I love what you said there. There's a breakdown in the sales process. That's a very, very good point. With that being said, Guap, thank you for letting me shorten your name. My God, you have a mouthful name. If we don't get Safe Plus, will 2023's theme be cannibalism among MSOs and SSOs? And that goes back to your point earlier. Should we be focusing on growth or focusing in on the operations we already have?
Focus on the operations. Be disciplined. Grow at a reasonable rate. Be thoughtful about how you do it, right? I think just survival this year and into next is going to put you in the top quartile, maybe even decile of operators. If you can remain cash flow positive, if you can get through it, it's tough. It's not sexy. It's not what anybody wants to hear necessarily. Sorry, Elliot, I don't mean to be a wet blanket on your show, but being disciplined and staying the course and being thoughtful and maybe going deeper in a particular state if you're going to try and be vertical, or really being thoughtful about how you expand, but doing it in such a way that you're growing at a reasonable rate and not overextending and growing too quickly where the cost of capital is going to flip you upside down.
Perfect. Colin Campbell, Managing Director, Sharp Capital Advisors. Thank you so much for joining us again, my friend. Always a pleasure having your insights on here. And we are pumped to see your announcements when they do come out. Thanks for teasing us.
Absolutely. Stay tuned.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, see you next time. Avi, some great insights there, man. Really good insights.
I love this.
Awesome. So honestly, I kind of dominated that. Thank you for bearing with me, Avi. I was just super interested in some of that because we live in it every day in terms of the state of this industry. I'm going to go with Alan Brockstein. Stock sucked last month, but who cares? Still optimistic.
Yes, sir.
Avi, give us a closing thought here, man. We're over time.
Yeah, man. So today I'm going to review the Benzinga Pro Stress Balls. No, I'm kidding. Because we're quite over time, I'm going to leave my review Product review for Thursday. Tune in at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific to Benzinga Cannabis Insider at the end of the show. I will be doing a couple of reviews on a topic I have decided to title Hide Your Weed. And it's different devices, either consumption or storage devices, that allow you to hide your weed and make it very discreet when moving around. Not that I recommend traveling with weed. I certainly recommend you avoid traveling with weed at all costs.
Trying to get people put in jail over your hobby.
You also might want to hide your weed for other reasons. I gave my mother a gift to one of the things I'm going to show on the next show. And it's for her to hide her weed from my dad. So
awesome, my friend.
You hide your weed.
Hide your weed, hide your wife. Awesome. Javi, love you. Aaron Thomas, love you. Guap, thank you for contributing to the show. Really appreciate you guys. See you Thursday.
See ya.